So my guest for this episode of Talking Bach is the one and only Roland Peelman, the current director of the Canberra International Music Festival. Welcome, Roland.
Hello. Hello, Madeline. It's very good to see you and to see you together with your best friend, I suppose.
That's right. My little Rosie. Oh, hello.
Rosie. Little Rosie.
It's very lovely to have her. We haven't had her on a podcast yet.
No. I've never done a podcast. I've never done a podcast with a dog.
Well, you see that, you know, there's two firsts for you here today, isn't there? Oh, look, I'm sure you have been asked this a million times before in innumerable interviews. But how did we get so lucky to have you as a resident here in Australia?
Oh, gosh, that seems a very straightforward question. I have been asked numerous times. You're not wrong. I should perhaps remind you, Madeline, that I arrived on the 1st of March 1984, and that is last month exactly 40 years ago, and that's how fast it has gone. I can't believe, you know, that it's been 40 years, which is obviously longer than I ever lived in Belgium, where I was before that. And as you can also guess, I have never looked back. It's been an amazing 40 years, I think. I'm so grateful to Australia for everything that it's done for me, for the opportunities I've had here. I've been able to work with incredible people, I feel. And I almost felt that right from the beginning, actually, arriving in a small place, Mount Gambier, in South Australia.
That's
You know, which is on the map, if I can just point that one out, for a town of 24,000 people. That's quite a thing, you know.
Why Mount Gambier?
Well, why Mount Gambier? That is, it's all quite a long story. I'll try and give you the potted version. The intention at first was, when I was living and when I was studying in Belgium, was to do further studies overseas. And I was interested in perhaps furthering my studies in America and so on. We took some information that turned out to be much harder than it seemed. I then studied in Cologne. I was in Germany for a few years, basically, pursuing my studies. But the idea of moving far away had been planted in our minds. And lo and behold, a few years later, we came to Australia. When I say we, I talk about us as a young family. I was married. I had two children by that stage. You know, things sort of go fast at some point. Mm-hmm. And it did go all very fast. And out of the blue, really, we decided to go for a little holiday to Australia in 1982, check the place out. And I mean, you have to understand, we had no relatives. We had no friends. So it was really, it's just a long shot,
absolutely,
really. And but we've never looked back. Out of that first visit, which, you know, we were basically backpackers, right? And we stayed in King's Cross. And I say, I will never forget, there was a strike on of the garbage collectors. So, and it was mid-March and it was hot. There were
and
cockroaches
stinky
everywhere because there were piles of rubbish just about everywhere in the middle of King's Cross. And you know King's Cross, you know what I mean? It's not Croydon, you know, it's not Australian suburbs. So, it was colourful, let's put it that way. And but we stayed 4 weeks, I think, in Australia. After a week in King's Cross, we spent a week in Redfern. It's a different experience altogether. We then took the train to Melbourne. And on the train to Melbourne, which is about the slowest possible train you can take in the Southern Hemisphere, we met this young lady from California who was seated actually just in between us. And we got into conversation because we were there with two little kids and we thought, can we please swap so that we can sit together with the kids? And that started the conversation. By the time Rosemary was her name. By the time Rosemary stepped off the train in Wagga Wagga, she knew all about us. She had our contact of the people we were going to stay with in Melbourne and passed it on to some people in Wagga Wagga. We went to Melbourne, stayed there. It was even hotter than in Sydney, I remember. It was so hot. It was Easter. We went for a trip. I encountered the Australian bush for the first time in my life. Wow. The Southern Ocean, all of it was an amazing experience, nature and so on. We came back to Melbourne and the phone rang. Not Rosemary, but a certain Roland Bannister introduced himself on the phone. And, you know, in those days, we didn't have internet or anything like that. It was landline, right? No mobiles. Landline. Hello. Could I please speak with Roland Bielman? You know, here is Roland Bannister. You know, I'm the director of the Riverina College of Education. And I just heard that you are in Australia and that you're sort of looking around. Why don't you come to Wagga Wagga and play for me? A week later, he got us on a plane. Ansett Airlines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Think
yeah,
about
yeah.
that. Oh, Ansett yeah. Airlines. So we were for the first time on a regional flight to Wagga Wagga, of all things. We arrive in Wagga Wagga. Rosemary was there on the tarmac picking us up. We were stayed with Rosemary. We had the funniest 3 days in our lives, probably. And the next day, I played for Roland Bannister. I remember I played Mozart and I played Schoenberg. Now, Schoenberg and Wagga Wagga,
yeah,
you might think,
say.
What happened there? Yeah. But hey, he sort of offered me a job.
Uh-huh. And you thought, and yeah, let's just leave it all behind.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's it, you know. And we even left some luggage behind in Wagga Wagga. And we went back to Belgium, of course. The immigration department said, you know, don't call us, we'll call you.
Oh, blimey.
And things didn't go particularly fast. We were sort of prepared for, you know, the bureaucracy to take its time and so on. By the end of the year, however, Roland Bannister had to unfortunately tell us that an Australian really wanted that job and that he was obliged to give the job to an Australian. So at that point, we realized, okay, it's not going to be Wagga Wagga. But my wife, Annette, was not to be deterred. She returned to Australia in February. She left me at home with the kids. She went to Australia, met various people in Melbourne, including a doctor, an amateur musician, violin-playing musician by the name of Owen. Oh, I've got his surname now, Owen. They met there, and he was interested in some more musicians going down to Mount Gambier. He introduced her to the whole town of Mount Gambier. And by that stage, we had a little bit of experience. She explained, you know what I mean? Do this, don't do that. Say this, don't say that. They put in a little ad in the local Border Watch. Impressive newspaper.
Wow.
Down in Mount Gambier.
What a name for news. It sounds like a program on the television.
Yeah, because it's not so far from the border with Victoria. And let me tell you, you got to watch it.
Well, you know, if it's one thing COVID taught me, it's watch borders.
So the Border Watch, and they put a little ad in on page 6 down the bottom. You know, down the bottom. And funnily enough, there was not a lot of response to that ad. And the rest is history. The following year, we emigrated to Australia, to Mount Gambier.
Amazing. And then you had a long relationship with the Song Company, the Australian Opera, and innumerable other things.
Yeah, you? Well, I didn't stay in Mount Gambier all that long. It's weird, actually, because it was a very lovely experience, I have to say, because people were so helpful, welcoming. And you can imagine this Belgian couple arriving in Mount Gambier. We were the talk of the town. You know, we hit the front page of the Border Watch before you knew it.
Do they have society pages in the Border Watch?
Totally. We were on daytime television in week 2.
Jeez, you really made a splash, didn't you?
We did. The thing is, there's no trouble finding students because we had to make a living, right?
Yeah.
So we had to teach, obviously. But I did all kinds of things in Mount Gambier. You know, I ended up conducting the brass band. I even wrote some pieces for them. And there was a little local orchestra. We started concerts in the art gallery, all kinds of things. And then Opera Australia offered me a job and we moved to Sydney. You know, we went to the Big Smoke, which was a lot harder, I tell you. Mount Gambier was easy peasy, and Sydney was difficult, I remember. And, you know, the whole, not just the city, you know, getting around.
Yeah.
So big, right?
Yeah.
The city, the professional life, working in the opera, really. It was, and I was a member of music staff, so you sort of have to do everything, right? And it was an extraordinary, hard-working company. So I learned a lot, as you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where I met you for the first time. And my sister.
Correct. Yes.
Was that 1994? When was that?
85, I think.
1985. Really?
I think 85 or 86. You were barely out of nappies, Madeline. And I was young and innocent. I was just a young new member of music staff. And they had, in those days, the Australian Opera, as it was called, had actually an education department. Well, they abandoned it later.
Yeah. Which is kind of astonishing. I feel I shouldn't express my personal views too much on this platform. However, I was pretty upset to find out that our flagship national opera company doesn't offer an education program. Am I allowed to say that?
Oh, you are. It was in one of the sort of rationalization purges, you know what I mean? Mm. Restructuring. Let's get back to core activity, all that. So, you know, the narrative. So, yeah, no, they ditched the education department. They thought it was probably too much work and not enough return, you know. And we all know that education departments, any organization who engages with education in whichever form, it costs money.
Yeah.
And it's not a commercial enterprise, you know, unless you are sponsored to do so or find particular benefactors, you know, you have to sort of develop the philanthropy as well for it. So anyway, that's history. But the fact is that we first met there in a school, well, not a school, sorry, and holiday production of Dido and Aeneas, entirely with auditioned people, young singers. They were all teenagers. I remember some very young singers of that
I remember time. Them being brilliant. And, you know, I was less than 10 years old, I think. I must have been.
You were very young.
Very, 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 very young. Yeah. And I just remember falling in love with that music, as did my sister. And, you know, it's you know, again, it's a real shame that these programs don't exist anymore, because when one does programs like that, it plants seeds. It lights a spark of something which will develop into a fire inspiration and you know you never know when you plant these little seeds what they're going to grow into.
I couldn't agree more. And of course, it's not like I am involved in education on a day-to-day basis, but these little opportunities arise to work with kids, really. With young kids. I remember last year at a festival, for example, you know, how we presented The Children's Crusade. It's a Benjamin Britten piece based on Bertolt Brecht. And this is not a laugh-a-minute piece. This is quite grim, bleak even, you know.
That surprises
it's about a group of children, you know, who get lost, basically. And so it's bleak. And it's really about children facing the horrors of war, the ravages of war, right? And the piece is not a walk in the park either from a musical point of view, you know. But of course, it's a brilliant piece because it's about children, and Britten wrote it for children.
Yeah.
So the entire cast is children who sing and play instruments, you know, percussion instruments, basically. And so absolutely, it was a magnificent achievement that we did with the young kids of Luminescence Children's Choir.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was really a very memorable evening. One of the most memorable evenings, actually, of last year's festival. Oh. So there you are.
Well, we are here to talk about this year's festival.
Yes.
So let's start by saying and acknowledging, very sadly, this is your last year as artistic director, but what an incredible legacy you've left for the festival. One thing I know about you, and we all think about you, is what an absolutely brilliant programmer you are. You know, there is no one like you. You're a one-off. this incredible, inspired mind that you have, and imagination and ideas and connections. And, you know, we are going to be very sad to see you go.
Wow. No, yeah. I'm not sad, you know, Madeline, and I don't think anybody ought to be sad. We realize that life changes, you know, and we also have to change in life, and that nothing is here forever.
That's true.
You know, music will, I think it's fair to say that music will be with us forever.
I hope so.
And we all like to contribute to that realization. Yeah. And, you know, music, it's what I love. It's what you love, clearly. And it's what keeps us going. Every day, it's what keeps me going, and it gives me a reason to get up every single morning. There's a few other reasons too. I can see, you know, Rosie here. I'm sure she's a reason to get up in the morning. But music is an amazing thing that keeps, you know, everything going in my mind. And there always is. There's a time to arrive, and there is a time to go. Right? There is a time to thank and say goodbye. And it's almost imminence now, and it's because I'm literally on the home stretch, but I have no regrets. And the thing is, you probably know this about me, Madeline, I've always been interested in all kinds of music.
Oh yeah.
I've never really been just obviously I was trained in Europe and trained within a particular tradition. I had no choice in that mm-hmm. was what was there. I'm not trained as a jazz musician. You know, I'm not a rhythm and blues guy, but I do like all that music.
Yeah.
I really
do. Me too. Very much so.
Yeah. And I've had over the years, of course, and ever since I was a child, you know, I had an engagement and a close connection with early music. Right?
Yeah.
All the way. I mean, when I was 13-year-old, you know, I discovered Lassus and Palestrina and Monteverdi, you know, and Gregorian chant, and Bach didn't come, followed soon thereafter.
Yeah.
So early music also is part of my DNA, and I've loved that, and I've been wanting to bring that into festival. And then you also know that I'm quite obsessed with and engaged in contemporary music, and again, contemporary music of all kinds. And so I've always wanted to bring all of that, you know, the totality, the wide experience of music into the festival. Art music, I need to say, you know, clearly the tradition of the festival was never an R&B festival. It never was a folk festival. We do have a folk festival, a national folk festival in Canberra. So it was an opportunity in the city of Canberra to create something, you know, to broaden the agenda, to make it forward looking, to really bring it into the 21st century, to take the whole notion of music festival out of the 19th century and bring it into the 21st century, and give it a purpose and a reason, you know, why we can, in this day and age, enjoy so many different types of music. So I've wanted to, you know, improvised music as well as notated music, early music as well as new music, music from a jazz tradition as well as music from a Baroque tradition, all of that. And I've sought to, I suppose, and because there already was a tradition of that in the festival, actually, of early music on period instruments. And contrary to most other festivals in Australia, I would say. And so I really wanted to continue that. And I also wanted the festival to be a springboard, if you like, or a platform for the specialists in early music in Australia, you know, because it's been a growing movement, as you know very well, for a long time. You know, all these people engaged with early music, they lived overseas. Yeah. They were in Holland or in England or somewhere else, right? But very few of them were actually in Australia. And that has changed over the last 10 to 20 years, right? Yeah. People have come back and have made a career, started an ensemble or an orchestra or whatever you want to call it. And now we have a plethora of choice, don't we?
Yes.
And so I really wanted that, wanted the festival to help, really, and with Bach Academy, I think. When you remember, Madeline, when the first time you came with the ensemble?
I do. We were at we were in Woollahra at a beautiful home, and I decided with the help of Anthony Jeffrey to just get a couple of people together. And I thought, I wonder how this is going to go down. Let's gauge with a reaction here. So I got together some singers and some instrumentalists, and we performed Bach's Cantata 105, Herr, gehe nichts in Gerichts. And that cantata, it's not the most sort of jubilant work, but I wanted to achieve something a little bit different. I wanted to get to people's hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't a cantata that's heard very often, but it does have not only that magical opening chorus,
yes,
but it has that incredible aria in the middle, which is just oboe and soprano. And that beautiful, beautiful soprano. There is no bass in that
and,
aria.
And,
it's just amazing. And then the last chorale, where the orchestra slows down one by one by one. And I thought, I need to open people's eyes a bit here and mm-hmm. gauge the reaction. But I also did the oboe and violin concerto, I think.
With, I don't remember that.
Did a little bit of that. I think Emma Black was in town.
Emma was in town.
Yes, and a little bit of the obbligato sonatas. Anyway, that was the end of
2016. It was the beginning,
End of 2016.
Yes.
That we did that. And you were there.
I was there. And you were right. And I think, and I thought, okay, did you come in 17?
We did. I looked it up before 17. You got
here. Oh, good. I'm glad you double-checked it. Because I was just thinking, was it 17 or 18? 17 it was. And yes, and it's coming back now. And you came back in 18.
Uh-huh.
And back in 2000. Because then I decided,
let's
not just do a little bit of Bach. Let's do a whole lot of Bach. And let's do, because it was the 25th anniversary of the festival in Canberra.
Yeah.
And also knew, of course, that Canberrians are real Bach lovers. They dig it. They really love it.
Hurrah.
And I thought, okay, let's build a festival around Bach. Not only will it please our patrons, no end, but it creates an even broader platform for Bach Academy Australia, because by that stage, you really sort of got your stuff together, right?
Mm-hmm.
You really got sort of organized and so on. Yeah. I could sense this is growing, this is going somewhere, this is not about to fall over. And, you know, in spite of COVID, which happened the year after, we were right. It wasn't going to fall over. And it was great. And it was probably, I'd say it was certainly the best attended festival that we've ever had. Our audience grew. It was an amazing festival, really. And it also gave us an opportunity of shining light on Bach in a slightly different way, mm-hmm. which you could do in a festival, right? And particularly, you know, this was never going to be a Bach fest like in Leipzig.
No.
Canberra is not Leipzig.
We're Australia.
We're Australia, mate. So, and we're Canberra. And Canberra is a city which is barely 100 years old. That's all of it is, right? So, before the city got built, it was just a paddock, right? With cows. And long, long, long before that, there were a whole number of indigenous peoples who either passed through the area, met in that particular part of the world, rarely stayed for a long time, you know, many indigenous nations really converged in that part of the world, the Wiradjuri, the Ngunnawal, you know, even the Yuin and so on, you know, depending on the season. So there is rich history, but clearly it's not Lutheran history. But it gave us an opportunity to invite an Daria choir from Hermannsburg.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I really wanted to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll allow me just to say that I thought this was the biggest stroke of genius I think I've ever seen in any festival, because it just showed me that we can unite the Western musical tradition that we come from with the land we stand on.
Mm-hmm.
And to do it through Bach was just, for me, the most heavenly thing that mm-hmm. you could have done. It was the most moving thing. I was just in tears at the end of
it. It was an extraordinary experience for everyone, I think. I mean, not because they are unknown, right? We have known about this Lutheran mission. For a long, long time, a century, right? Mm-hmm. The Lutheran pastors arrived in South Australia and then in Central Australia since the late 19th century, right? And they set up the mission there, they built a little church and so on and so on. But they, right from the word go, they wanted not only connect with the language, they started the first dictionary, you know, the first dictionary of the Aranda language, the Pichichinchara language. And then, most importantly, they wanted people to sing because they were Lutherans, right? They wanted to sing hymns in the vernacular, in their own language. So they started translating Strelow, right? So Karl Strelow. They started translating the Lutheran chorales into the local language. And so what started sometime in the early 20th century is something extraordinary. And it's not quite finished. Perhaps it feels like somehow it's wrapping up because clearly the Lutheran mission is not as big anymore as it once was.
And for those of you who don't know about this, this mission is in a place called Hermannsburg, about 120 kilometres southwest of Alice Springs. Yeah, and the mission came up the old telegraph line, which was built from Darwin, Adelaide to Darwin,
yes.
Which connected Australia to the rest of the world. And it was incredibly, incredibly tough going. And did they come up by camel or horseback?
No, with carts and horses and so on. And they took cattle with them and so on, you know, because they it was sort of trying to establish a European-inspired rural existence in the middle of the desert, right? I mean, it's extraordinary reading, as you know. But the extraordinary thing too, from a musical point of view, and for people like us who are interested in Bach and the Bach traditions around the world, what happened is, and it is documented only partially, I would say, because, you know, when they first built the church, taught the hymns, and as you know, the mission became a bit of a drawing pole, right? For a lot of the indigenous tribes, for a lot of the nomadic tribes, particularly at times when there was a shortage of food and so on. As you know, the moment the Brits arrived, you know, in the late 18th century, all kinds of things happened, of course. They took over the land. They took the land, as a matter of fact. And there was never an agreement on that. But they also brought the cattle, which destroyed the land, right? Mm-hmm. And which took away the ancient food sources, right? So a whole number of problems arose in the second half of the 19th century, and the establishment of missions and stations and so on became then a sort of a way of alleviating, of giving people provision to food and so on, right? And so everything sort of changed, you know. New problems arose with that, of course. Which is, of course, a very different subject altogether. I deviate somewhat. The people in the missions were taught these hymns, basically. They sang it in their own language, and both men and women sang, right? So, and they were basically taught that the hymns were translated in the new language, but they were accompanied by organ. There was a little organ, a harmonium there, and so on. It's still there,
I saw it. I went there.
Still there.
Yeah.
It's still there. Yeah. And the earliest recordings, field recordings we have of that, date from the early 50s, 1950s. Oh. So it is already 50 years hence. But you could hear, and it's very poor quality recordings, as you can imagine. You could still hear the organ in the background, and you can still hear the men sing. So it was still a four-part sort of Bach's harmonizations, right? Mm. It still resembled the four-part versions that Bach wrote with tenors and basses and so on. The next major development that happened was in the 1970s, and this came about because of Albert Namatjira.
The artist.
The artist.
Yes.
And the fact that Albert was a visual artist, started painting, basically, you know, watercolors and everything else. So he went into the McDonald Ranges and started painting. And it created a movement. And it from that point onwards, the men lost their interest in singing and started taking up the paintbrush.
Gosh, I didn't realize.
That's what happened. But what happened as a result of that is that the men stopped singing in the church, and then the two parts of the chorale, of the harmonizations, were the bass basically disappeared.
Whoa.
And the tenor was sung by low voices, female voices, and sometimes just the octave up.
Okay.
So it became a different, it became a different thing.
Oh my gosh! So the music itself
evolved. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the extraordinary thing. What's happened through these hundred years, approximately, and you can hear that in the recordings of around the 70s.
Wow.
70s, early 80s.
Incredible.
Yes. And then you listen to recordings of the 90s or the early noughties, and you will hear that the organ by that stage also stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And with that stopped the more regular prosody that had been maintained through the rhythm. You know what I mean? The rhythm of the that somehow was still there. But the DNA of these Bach chorales or Bach harmonizations bit by bit changed. And so first the lower parts disappeared, and then the rhythm started getting very loose.
I did notice that when they came and sang. Very loose.
And what remained effectively is a sort of chant-like gradual moving of the parts.
Yes.
You know, not as clearly aligned as we would expect it from a well-trained choir. And it became chant-like, basically. Also, the words in their language, Arendi, are much longer words than they are, ever are in you know, in German.
I don't know much about.
So it, yeah. You know what I mean? So the way, I mean, as you know, Bach didn't compose the tune of the chorales, right?
No.
They're by Walter, by Luther, some of them, by various people, right? Mm. He just harmonized them. But they were, of course, written inspired by the words.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The word emphasis falls naturally, as it does in the German. And they are in 3-4, most in 4-4, a little faster or a little slower. They're all a bit different, clearly. Mm. But they follow the words.
Yes.
And there's regular patterns to that, you know? Two bar patterns or 3-bar patterns or 4-bar sentences, you know?
Mm.
With a fermata at the end, so for everyone to catch up, you know, and then go on to the next line, isn't it? So what happened the moment that the language changed, it became more and more idiomatic to their language. The Bach harmonization is sort of a distant memory. It's still in the DNA there, but it's no longer on the surface. It's hid, it's buried almost into it, and it's become their hymns. You know, it's an extraordinary phenomenon, I think.
Yeah.
And it says something about how music transforms once it is transplanted into a different continent, and this continent, and particularly Hermannsburg, Daria, you know, in their language, you know, couldn't be further away.
It could not be further away
from this, from these little rural towns in Westphalia or Sachsen and so on.
Yeah.
You know, it's an extraordinary story, really, and this happened in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't go further away.
I know.
From Germany,
especially with a culture that's more than 60,000 years old. You know, but it does say something about the nature of Bach's music and how it endures and how it inspires.
Yeah. Tells me something about the resilience of those people who have been there 60,000 years, who had their land taken away, who had their land destroyed, who had their sources of food taken away, who then had their children taken away, you know, to make matters better even, you know, had their children taken away and then had to come to terms with building up a new life and finding their voice. Their voice, in the end, is what prevails. even though Bach's DNA is in there, but it's their voice. And it's a very different voice. It's not a Lutheran trained voice.
No, by no means. I just think it was amazing. And when you brought them there and they sang the last chorale of Wacht auf to end that festival. Oh, no. It wasn't the last concert. BWV 147 was the last concert. But
They sang that chorale. They really are a very... it's sort of their party piece.
Yeah.
Wacht auf. Yeah. There's something about
it. It's everyone's party piece. Oh, no, that's just wonderful. Yeah, yeah. Now, why the Brandenburg Concertos for this year's festival?
Well, I could give you the very first and simple answer is that we've never had all the Brandenburgs together in the festival.
Okay, then.
Number one, right?
Yeah, right.
We've actually, at some point in the festival... I mean, single Brandenburg concertos have been featured in the festivals before me. I remember conducting B minor mass in the festival. Various cantatas have featured in the festival. We've, as you know, in 2019, we had St. John's Passion as well. Quite a lot of Bach we've had, but we've never had all of the Brandenburg concertos. And I should also tell you, Madeline, that my initial idea about this festival, the 2024 festival, my last festival, was to do something around the idea of joy. Not just because music brings joy, of course it does, you know, but it brings all kinds of things, you know what I mean? It's joy can also be a fairly limiting concept, right? Particularly in Western languages. I discovered, for example, that in most indigenous languages, there's no word for joy.
Really?
There are all kinds of words that somehow capture something around it, you know, perhaps it's words that we might call contentment, that we might say contentment, for example, you know, equanimity or surprise, you know, elation, you know, but joy in the way we use the word joy, it actually doesn't feature. So I started looking for words in indigenous languages that would, you know, and I found a different kind of word, which doesn't really say joy, but so the word Mulangari came out of that search. Yes,
I understand.
Which is shared by many peoples from around that area. It's a concept, and it means alive and strong. Some of it has the connotation like, you know,
Enlivenment.
Yes, and and empowerment also. And I thought, well, that's actually, it's a beautiful word, Mulangari.
Yeah, it is.
It's a beautiful word, number one. It sounds, it's got a great sound about it. Secondly, we ought to celebrate live music. That's kind of what a festival is about. Also, we ought to celebrate the fact that our indigenous people are alive.
Yes.
In spite of everything, and that the culture is alive. And that's what I've been trying to prove over these last 10 years, right?
Yeah.
But also, there's something about in Bach's music too, that transcends everything. And with everything, I also mean the things that go wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about the children that died, which was a regular occurrence, right? Yeah. You know, a new child is born. It's not expected to survive beyond its first year. The statistics will say in the 18th century, you know, 50% chance, you know.
Of any child.
Yeah, almost any child, right? And let's not forget Bach in Leipzig was also took care of the musical education of 50 boys, right? It's quite common for some of them just to die. To pass away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He wrote a lot of funeral music, right? Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Motets.
That was, motets and cantatas too, you know, which is all about passing away. The Passions, you know, two big pieces, huge pieces, right? You know, sizable pieces, which is all about the loss of life. You know, the passions are not about resurrection. The passions are about the passion. Yes, yeah. It's about the suffering and the death and how we deal with that, how we cope with
that. It was such an ever-present part of life, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, much more that for them than it was
exactly, for us. Exactly. Yeah. You know, you know about how, you know, he when he arrived back from a 3 or 4 month trip, you know, with his boss, and he comes home to find out that his wife had died.
Yeah, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was, you know, it wasn't, you know, the life was tough. And Bach was, you know, of a sturdy disposition, as we say, clearly, you know. He lived a long life in comparison to many other people. The moment, of course, that he moved to Leipzig, you know, he was very engaged with religious music and with the Lutheran services and so on and so forth. But before that, when he worked for Leopold, right, who was Calvinistic, you know, he was discouraged, you know. He was discouraged to write for the church. They weren't interested in, you know. The right said, you know, we don't do any of that sort of singing and having fun in church, you know. We're having fun outside the church, thank you very much.
Yes.
So, time to write concertos, you know, instrumental music. And he wrote an enormous amount, as you know, and we're very grateful for that fact, aren't we?
We are, as violinists, especially.
Yeah, I'd say so. And keyboard players, you know. What would we do without all of that? But he wrote these 6 concertos, you know, not involving any vocalists and so on, and 6 very different pieces.
Yeah.
Very different. They're not, it's not like he didn't do what Vivaldi did or what Tartini or all the other Italians did. You know, let's just write another
12 concertos for one instrument.
Exactly, for same combination of string instruments, you know what I mean, with all these concerto grossos and so on. He didn't, he never wrote concerto grossi, but he did write concerti for all kinds of instruments. And this is what I've always been fascinated by too, that Bach was supremely interested and engaged with the building of instruments, the technology of instruments. Yeah. He was really, he sought it out, right?
Well, he had been from the age of 11, right?
Yeah, yeah. Always was so keen in the mechanics of it, right? The mechanics of it. What made an organ, and how, you know, how do you create a different kind of sound, but also how do you create a different sound out of a horn and a trumpet? You know, how can you go higher on a cornetto, and so on? You know, how can you go low on an oboe, and so on? What that means? You know, the manufacture of the instruments, the building of it, the fingering of how to deal with it, and so on. And he was always engaged with people like that. You know, with the technique of it.
Yeah.
He didn't just sit there in his ivory tower and write lovely music. Yeah. You know, here's a lovely tune, and here's a lovely harmony. No, never, never. He was really engaged with the practicalities of it. He was a very pragmatic guy and a very practical guy. And he was interested in also in pushing, you know, pushing the barriers a little bit, right? How can we do a little bit more?
Yeah.
And to the end of his life, right?
Yeah.
And as you know, the 5th Brandenburg, the one where the harpsichord features prominently, you know, he wouldn't have written that if he hadn't been 2 years before to Leipzig to order a new harpsichord, you know, for the court, and see what's possible. A bigger one. And perhaps if it's a bit bigger, it might also be a little bit louder, and you could do, you know, stronger effects on it. And he uses all of that, right?
I did not know that. I did not know about that little trip to Leipzig. Thank you for that.
2 years before.
I've learned something.
Yes. What was the year? 1719 or something like that. I'll need to double check it. But yes, he went on a trip in order to order a new, or to make sure that there could be a new harpsichord at the court.
Okay.
They're clear for whatever reason. The harpsichords weren't quite, didn't do the trick anymore, you know, and clearly there was the money to order a new one. So we went there to Berlin, and talk to the builders and so on. And but the same applies to all of those instruments that he featured, you know, because he had met. It's not like Bach sat in his room all day, every day. They did go on trips.
Yes.
They did travel.
Yeah.
He met musicians in different towns.
Yeah.
And occasionally he met a trumpeter. Well, fantastic over there, you know. Mm. And an oboe player who could do things he hadn't heard yet. You know, he was fascinated by that.
And the violino piccolo.
Yes.
That's incredible. Yeah, yeah, the scordatura and the quadruple stops and everything on that.
Oh, no, no.
You know, it's staggering.
And I always think, I mean, I don't know how you think about it, Madeline, but when I hear these pieces, when I see these pieces, when I see the score, it's the joy of doing something different, something new, the joy of just creating music, you know? It's not about God.
No. Well, it's not about God, but there's a kind of... there's a sort of a religious experience that can be created and felt.
A subliminal religious experience.
Maybe it's more a sense of transcendence.
Yeah, I think
so. A kind of a group feeling of joy.
And I mean, Bach was a guy, he knew his Bible, as you know.
Yeah.
And he was clearly engaged with the Lutheran service, you know what I mean? And he was a deeply religious man. Absolutely. Mm. No one will ever take that away. And, you know... SDG, Soli Deo Gloria,
yes.
You know, it was there to him, you know, the ulterior purpose of writing music was, it wasn't just to satisfy himself. It wasn't just to make his boss happy. It wasn't to make his wife happy. You know what I mean? Yeah. And maybe he did make his boss happy.
Yeah.
But more often than not, the boss would complain.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, they would complain, don't give us so much chromaticism, Johann, you know what I mean? Give us something simple, give us a nice tune, please. You know, all of that nonsense, right? Which goes on and on and on. It still goes on, right? 300 years later, it's still the same nonsense goes on. And it was palpable then, right? As you know, we got the job in Leipzig. It was only the third, what is it?
Yeah, the third candidate.
Third choice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, reluctantly, they thought, okay, then we better have this Bach guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary, really, how it was. So clearly, he wasn't writing in order to please people, you know.
No.
I think he knew for himself what good music was.
Yes.
You know, what good composition was. He had quality, you know. He knew what was quality. And he could hear the difference between trash and quality.
Oh, yeah.
He could.
Yeah.
And even if his bosses didn't necessarily appreciate it, he did. So that's the integrity that the man maintained throughout his life.
He
right?
was a man of integrity through
totally.
And through, wasn't he?
Totally integrity. And it made him a grumpy man at times, you know, and frustrated very often, I think. But nevertheless, I think the integrity of the craft, the commitment to the craft, in that sense too, he wasn't the ultimate craftsman, in a sense that, do you know, the craft of creating a concerto, the craft of creating a good cantata, the craft of writing a new suite, the craftsmanship involved in getting a really tough fugue to work. You know, from a structural point of view, from a sound point of view, from an inventive point of view, from a narrative point of view, that is craftsmanship, supreme craftsmanship. And at times, of course, there was also supreme inspiration there, clearly, because he could write a good tune. <De-da-dum,
de-da-dum. laughs> But that really inspires me as a performer.
Yeah, of course.
Because, you know, what we do as performers and interpreters, we take these notes and we try to craft them. You know what I mean? And that's what I try to do every day with Bach Academy.
Yeah, yeah, it's craft.
Every time.
It's craft.
Every minute of every rehearsal, I am you've seen me work, you've seen me play and everything. I'm trying to craft. You know, and I hope that comes through in performances.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we really...
That's what it's about.
And, you know, we work so hard, you know, but it's worth it, you know. It does. And every minute of my practice, you know,
Yeah.
It's about crafting those notes too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so in that sense, because, you know, as you know, books have been written about comparisons, you know, between Bach and Handel and so on. And Handel, of course, who was a bit of a showman and loved the theatre and wrote for the theatre, you know, and in the theatre you have to write for stars.
Yeah.
For divas, you know? Mm. And there are many, many, many stories about that, you know?
Yes,
and
of course,
so
yeah.
You serve a different kind of purpose, right?
Yes.
And it is really about that moment, you know, when someone wants to shine in an aria, and when an extraordinary performer also can transport everyone, right? But that sort of star cult, it's part of that, right?
Yes.
They didn't make him write bad music, far from, but the purpose was very different.
Yeah.
And the craftsmanship also was different, right?
Mm.
And both of them, of course, you know, were forever writing and rewriting, you know, adapting, transcribing, because they always ran out of time, of course. And, you know, there was no photocopier around the corner, right? So everything had to be done by hand. So you needed assistants, you needed, you know, children or wives, you know, to help with the copying out and so on. There's never enough time, right? That's the whole thing. And then the damn thing had to be rehearsed as well. You know, that was usually for Saturday. Saturday you rehearse. Sunday you spend all day in church, right?
Yeah.
And then Sunday evening you can finally sit down and smoke a pipe.
Have a glass of beer or port or something. I know. But these Brandenburg concertos are amazing. And to, you know, what about this job application of his? What about this, you know? Yeah, have a look at these.
It's very funny reading.
I need to get out of town here. Have these concertos.
Yeah, yeah. But he was always, of course, looking for a better job or perhaps a greater job, some kind of promotion. And, oh, yeah, he had many goes at that, right? As you know, the Kyrie and the Gloria from the B minor Mass is a kind of job application, which went nowhere.
And the Missa Brevises.
Yeah.
The Missa Brevi.
Also, yeah. Also that. And these six concertos, which clearly he was going to write anyway, right? You know, because it suited his employment. It was clearly, you know, suited his employment also. And he had probably better players than the guy the Margraf, he dedicated it to. But you know what I mean? You have to hedge your bets both ways. You never know. Never know, right?
Yeah.
And clearly he had met the guy on that trip to Berlin 2 years earlier. And the guy loved music. But he was actually, and it's well documented, the Margraf was a real fan of Handel. And he didn't really tell Bach that. You know, we know from the correspondence and so on. But and clearly he was probably a nice man and clearly admired Bach's skills on the keyboard as an improviser and so on. But Bach obviously went away thinking, he could be a future employer.
Yeah.
He likes music. We might as well, once he'd done the six concertos, send him a little present, you know, with his very groveling dedication and so on, you know. And again, of course, nothing came of it. The good thing was is that they were, we don't know whether they were disdainful, but they probably opened up the first page and thought, oh, that's
That's
a bit difficult.
Yeah.
A bit difficult. So, and then someone put it away on the shelf and that's it.
Till 1975 or something?
No. It was discovered in around 1850.
Okay, a big
on an attic. And someone who was doing a cleaning job.
Right. Okay, I got that right.
Someone who was did a cleaning job and found this. And it was in a map, in I think a red kind of folder, right? Which had been unopened all those years, which is why the autograph is in such good shape, actually.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing that Bach thought, oh, nothing will come of this? But then look what did come of it.
Yes.
I mean, Brandenburg II was sent up on the Voyager probe into space.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, as one of the shining examples of the greatest of the human race could produce.
Exactly.
Yeah. So look what did come of those. Well,
amazing things came
out.
You know, and out of that first find on the attic in 1850, out of that meant that the works were incorporated in the first big edition of it by the Bach Gesellschaft, you know, by that stage, the Bach Gesellschaft existed and set itself the task of publishing all of Bach's works. You know, it started, I've forgotten the exact year, 1870s, you know, late 19th century. Yeah. So it was incorporated in that, and performances followed from there. And, you know, and the rest is history, as they say.
I know.
But the joyfulness of the music, I have to say, that was the first thing why I thought, let's have the Brandenburg. The joy. The joy of in every note, in every bar, is an unbelievable music. And I generally resent generic descriptions of music. You know, music is, it can be anything you like it, you want it to be, you know. Music is music. It's what, the way we perceive it. And, but I think to music is, there is something uplifting. Every single time I have heard that music, and I also know how other people seem to react to it, that it's upbeat music, isn't it?
I know. I was playing it just this afternoon when I was teaching, right before we recorded this, and I was just doing a bit of practice. I played, and the 7-year-old in the next room, he didn't know that I could see him, and he was like, he just started bopping around like this, and I just thought, that's an instinct, that's a childish instinct to move to this music, and this is what this music contains.
Yeah,
and he had a smile on his face.
It dances, right? Yeah, it dances.
Yeah, totally. It was just extraordinary.
Yes, and all of them, you know, and people can say, oh, well, you know, that 6th Brandenburg Concerto, you know, which has no violins, no recorders, no oboes, no wind instruments at all. You know, these really old-fashioned gambas and violas and so on and so on and so on. But that too,
oh my gosh,
is beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful, not in a kind of, it doesn't hit you in the face, perhaps, you know, there's a certain restraint about it, but the fact too that he was always, that he wasn't just interested in the new instruments or in the innovations, you know, in instrument building and what instruments could do more, but he was also interested in the old instruments, some of the instruments that really were about to be relinquished, right? Like the viola da gambas, it was sort of on its way out.
I think he was interested in the timbre and the colours that he could achieve with different combinations of instruments. That, you know, sort of two recorders, for example, like in Actus Tragicus, two recorders, two gambas, the sonorities that he could do.
The sound.
Mm-hmm. And the keys he chose.
Yes, of course.
The colours of the keys combined.
And the keys that would work well for that instrument, right? Yeah. He was acutely aware of what can work on an instrument, what doesn't work on another instrument. Mm. Yeah.
Well, altogether, these 6 works are of staggering ingenuity, inventiveness, and joy. And we cannot wait to get down there and present it. It's a huge thing for us. It's a great undertaking for us. It's almost like a coming of age.
And is it 10 years that you've been going? How when did you first start?
No, it's not yet 10. 2000, our first public concert was 2017.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So, 7 years.
Yes.
7 years is a holy number, Madeline. 7 years. It's about time you did a Brandenburg. The thing is, too, as a Bach, as an ensemble, dedicated to Bach. So you've played quite a lot of music over those 7 years by now, right?
And
all of it Bach.
Well, not
all. Or about 98%, perhaps.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, because after the 20 years I spent in Europe playing Bach, it's one thing to perform it, tour it, and record it, but it's another thing to direct it. And I feel like every year that goes by, I feel more comfortable. I'm sort of growing into that role.
Yeah,
and,
I've noticed that.
well, thank you. But every year I sort of feel more comfortable with it, but at the same time realize how much I don't know.
that's the thing. But the music is not written to provoke one question and one answer. It the music often provokes many questions and certainly even more answers. I really feel that, and that's the thing in the 2019 festival, for example, that I also wanted to sort of demonstrate, of how many options there remain, that you can do Bach on guitar, you can do Bach with saxophones, you can do Bach on piano, you know. It's not, you know, there is no law against that. You can do it on organ, you can do it on harpsichord, you can do it on recorder, you can do it on almost any, you can do it on a synthesizer. Not very long ago, actually, I heard the prelude or the toccata, the first movement of the second English suite, done on a synthesizer. And it was riveting.
I bet.
It was amazing. And it was a really funky piece of music, let me tell you. Really funky. Not a single note was altered, right? Don't know. The accentuation was a little perhaps slightly different to what you would hear, the way you would hear it on a harpsichord. And it was done by an early music specialist, actually. Mm. It was fantastic. You know, Anthony Romaniuk. Mm. It was in Belgium that I heard that. And it was one of the highlights of that concert, actually. It was just amazing. And it shows, right, what people and subsequent generations will continue to find new answers.
They will, long after we've gone.
Yeah, very much so. And find new ways of bringing that music alive again. And that's
alive. Well, that's what we're going to do in mm-hmm. Canberra. And yes, it's going to be an amazing experience. Well, congratulations in advance for this incredible festival. Thank you for coming and being my guest today. It's been, as always, incredible to talk to you. I love our conversations. I love your enthusiasm. I learned so much from you. And yeah, I feel incredibly grateful that you've chosen Australia for your home. And,
well, it always feels like Australia chose me, Madeline. But it's just a fluke of history, really. Yeah,
all the best things come.
But the best things come out of that, absolutely. And yeah. I'm very grateful for the fact that you have come back to Australia and started an ensemble dedicated to Bach. Thank you.
Well, long live Bach. So I hope you've enjoyed that wonderful conversation I just had with Roland Peelman, the artistic director for this year for the Canberra International Music Festival. If you'd like to find out more about the festival, jump on our website, www.bachacademyaustralia.com.au, or even better, go straight to the festival, CanberraInternationalFestival.org.
CIMF, Canberra International Music Festival, so CIMF.org.au.
Straight from the horse's mouth. So we'll see you there.